Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to Solutions Watch. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and this week's program comes to you in June of 2024 in the context of the recent release of my mini podcast documentary on the future of food, which was released as episode 460 of the Corbett Report podcast proper. If you haven't seen it yet, what are you doing? Please stop and watch it. I think it is worth your time and attention because it provides a lot of detail about the problem that we are facing when it comes to, well, feeding ourselves, if nothing else. Yes, what is food and what will constitute food in the future if the technocratic tyrants get their way? This is an important question to understand because although I am sure that everyone in the Corbett Report audience already has some degree and idea of understanding of this problem, I think it is important to understand the incredible new technologies that are coming online right now that in some cases are already entering the food supply system that most people, including even switched on informed people in the Corbett Report audience, probably have no idea even exist. The Ento engine, a genetically modified fruit fly that can be used to produce proteins that are important in the synthetic creation of lab-created meat substitute gunk, or the bioengineered spores that will be used as DNA barcodes to track every single piece of produce down to the genetic level through all the way through the entire system from farm to fork and everywhere in between, or the new types of incredible, I can't believe it's not sugar, peptides that can be produced by genetically modified bacteria that produce these peptides that the company brags, well, we can market this as non-GMO because the peptides themselves aren't genetically modified. No, it's the bacteria that are being bioengineered to produce this that are the genetically modified component of that, so you don't even have to know about that. As I say, if you haven't seen the future of food yet, you really don't know the full extent of the problem that we're facing in simply trying to eat natural, healthy substances in line with what the abundance of the world around us, rather than this incredibly industrialized factory farming system that is dependent on all of the types of synthetic inputs and is increasingly going to be dependent on these insane technologies that most people, if given a choice, if given an informed choice, would not choose to not only shove in their mouths, but their children's mouths. No, thank you. So again, I think it is important to understand the problem, and that is why I released episode 460 on the future of food. But hopefully you did watch that production through to the end, where you saw towards the end, of course, the important part of this is once we understand the problem, the reason for understanding the problem is so that we can better confront it and do something about it and put ourselves into the mix as active participants, co-creators of the world around us, so that we can change this direction. The future of food has not been written in the stars. It is not decided yet. It is ours to decide, and we play a part in that. So there are many, many, many aspects to as you can imagine, an overwhelming, overarching problem like this. There are many different aspects to the solutions that will be necessary to see our way through this. And I have talked about some of those in the past. I hope, for example, you caught my recent flashback to my 2013 production on how to boycott big food. Also in 2013, I released a solutions episode of the Corbett Report podcast called Boycotts and Bicots, which talked about not only the boycotting of big food, but how we can boycott, that is, actually support those local organic farmers and producers and others that we actually want to be producing our food. I've talked about, for example, solutions, guerrilla gardening back in 2015. Do you remember that one? If not, please go back and revisit it. It's an important production. The future of food is ours to decide was actually the specific third part of the future of food article series that future of food podcast documentary was produced from, which I released back in the early part of 2023. And I did a community gardens edition of Solutions Watch talking about community gardening and the types of things that people can get involved in directly themselves to try to change the constitution of what is on their plate. And as always, I will say There's a lot of resources. I will be linking to all of these in the show notes, so please do go make use of them. And please don't do the propagandist's dirty work for them by demotivating yourself by thinking that this type of solution is either an all-or-nothing proposition. Either you go 100% self-sustained, totally organic, I grow everything I eat myself, or it's 0%. I'll just go to the supermarket and eat whatever crap they're forcing down my throat. It is not that type of binary, and don't let yourself think that it is. Having said that, we're going to look at a different, but related, aspect to the solution to this overarching problem today, and that is regenerative agriculture. And the first question that you should have when you ask, when you hear this title is, well, what is regenerative agriculture? Great! Bing, bing, bing. Okay, let's get definitions sorted, because that is the first step towards understanding in any and every subject, this subject being no exception. So, regenerative agriculture, well, there's a lot of different definitions that you can get. It basically depends on whom you're asking as to what specific answer you're going to get to that question. But it's certainly related and tangential or adjacent to various topics that will probably already be familiar to you. For example, organic gardening or organic farming, as well as permaculture. But it is not those things. It is its own entity entirely, and it is something that is still forming. So there has not been a set definition yet, but if you want something approaching some sort of standardized definition, I guess we can turn to the bastion of truthiness, because that's where we learn at the very least what the mainstream understanding of various things are, this being no exception. So let's turn to the Wikipedia entry for regenerative agriculture, which informs us that regenerative agriculture is a conservation and rehabilitation approach to food and farming systems. It focuses on topsoil regeneration, increasing biodiversity, improving the water cycle, enhancing ecosystem services, supporting biosequestration, say that three times fast, increasing resilience to climate change, and strengthening the health and vitality of farm soil. Regenerative agriculture is not a specific practice itself. Rather, proponents of regenerative agriculture use a variety of sustainable agriculture techniques in combination. Practices include recycling as much farm waste as possible and adding composted material from sources outside the farm. Regenerative agriculture on small farms and gardens is often based on philosophies like permaculture, agroecology, agroforestry, restoration ecology, now I can't talk at all, sorry, key line design, and holistic management. Large farms are also increasingly adopting regenerative techniques and often use no-till and/or reduced-till practices, etc., etc. As soil health improves, input requirements may decrease and crop yields may increase as soils are more resilient against extreme weather, etc., etc. So, as you can garner from that definition, which, again, this is not some sort of standard definition that everyone will accept, but it gives you at least some inkling of what's going on here. And, of course, it gestures towards climate change and carbon dioxide, because exactly as in the space of, say, permaculture, which is teeming with people who are involved and interested and invested in that particular way of approaching the earth, precisely because they have bought hook, line, and sinker into the lies of the anthropogenic global warming story that is being used to ultimately sell us our technocratic enslavement. Well, again, in regenerative agriculture, you're going to have some of the same types of people working in this space that are unfortunately stuck in false paradigms. But I would say, even if you're working from false assumptions, you can still actually be doing good things. And at any rate, as always, we have to separate wheat from chaff. So undoubtedly, when you start exploring regenerative agriculture, as you will after this podcast, you will find those who are pushing the global warming garbage as well. But I think as competent adult human beings, I trust in your ability to separate wheat from chaff and understand what is valuable here and what is propaganda. Having said that, again, this is not a standard definition, and in fact, that might be a good thing. In order to understand why not having a set standardized definition for something that that everyone must agree to and then adhere to, and then there must be some sort of body this creating standards and regulating it, we can turn, for example, to what happened to the organic movement arising in the 80s, 90s, taking off, becoming quite large, becoming an industry, and becoming standardized and certified and having certification bodies that will certify organic and non-organic, and it becoming a political contest of sorts that stifles innovation and different ways of approaching and thinking about this. So perhaps having a sort of amorphous explanation rather than definition of regenerative agriculture may be a benefit. And in order to further expound on that idea, we're going to turn to someone who knows more than I do about what they're talking about with regards to this, specifically John Kempf, who is the host of the Regenerative Agriculture podcast, which I note now has over 120 episodes on various regenerative agriculture conversations, essentially, that are being hosted with various people who are working in this space, because it is important to understand this isn't some airy-fairy, pie-in-the-sky idea that exists in some netherworld of hopes and dreams. This is something that people are actually applying right now. Working actual farmers who actually make their living from the soil are doing that in regenerative practices. So, in order to understand this more, I will... I have only recently come across this podcast, but so far I have found it extremely interesting and enlightening, so I will direct you in the direction of regenerativeagriculturepodcast.com so you can start exploring their archives. And on that note, I can already recommend a couple of their episodes, which I thought were interesting and will give you a good sense of what's going on here. For example, episode 121 on building a truly regenerative kitchen with Molly Engelhart is interesting. It takes the regenerative agriculture broad term and looking at it from not the producer side, but the ultimate end user side of someone who runs a restaurant that is attempting to source and create essentially dishes from regenerative agriculture products. Also, there's a short podcast on MacroPack and the importance of calcium. Listen to those podcasts, and I think you will get the sense. This is a no-nonsense, real, practical, actual farmer slash someone who has worked with farmers all his career, who knows what they are talking about with regards to this. And this is not theoretical. Having said that, we're going to listen to a very specific conversation from episode 94 of the Regenerative Agriculture podcast, which was an interview that someone on another podcast was doing of John Kempf. So he got a chance to outline his vision of what regenerative agriculture is, and also why it is beneficial to avoid that trap of falling into the organic, this is what organic farming and organic produce is, and we will standardize and certify it. He talks a little bit about why that's important to avoid that trap, but also expounds on his idea of what regenerative agriculture actually is.
My personal vision and mission is to have regenerative agriculture become mainstream globally, to have significant adoption, 80% adoption by 2040 is the goal that I've stated for myself. And one of the challenges that emerged from the use of organic certification is that it immediately created an in-group and an out-group, and it immediately created an us versus them dynamic. And there were other scenarios and other stuff going on involved in that as well. But having an us versus them dynamic is not healthy and not useful, particularly not if we want to gain significant adoption on a wide scale. So there are arguably some possible advantages to having it be a bit more amorphous and being a bit more adaptable and fluid. But as this conversation is evolving, I'm observing people are rapidly defining regenerative agriculture in the context of soil health. We started 20-some years ago, or perhaps longer, with a group of key individuals within the USDA and within NRCS defining what was initially 5 soil health principles, and then recently they added a 6th one. They're now called the 6 soil health principles. And then magically, a couple of years ago, these 6 soil health principles were redefined as the 6 principles of regenerative agriculture. And this is a very short-sighted view from my perspective. And I have a few challenges with it. One is that it places complete responsibility for regeneration on the farmer and places no responsibility on the other stakeholders in the supply chain. So it's again a case of asking farmers to do more and other aspects of the supply chain extracting that value rather than working with growers or benefiting growers for the additional work that they're doing. So that's a fundamental challenge that I see in that particular framing. Regeneration at its most fundamental level is about regenerating relationships. At all levels, regenerating relationships between plants and soil microbes, between livestock and the landscape, and it also needs to include regeneration in the relationships in the supply chain and producers. Right now, when you think about regenerating relationships, you're going from A to B. What is A and what is B? A, what I would call a degraded relationship, is a relationship that is extractive and that is not collaborative. You're trying to seek for yourself as much as you can at the expense of the other. It is a competitive relationship. And that's the type of relationship that exists today between most ag input suppliers and their customers, between offtake and producers. And instead, we need deeply collaborative and synergistic and symbiotic relationships. And what that could look like is, instead of General Mills and other large CPG companies requesting that farmers be regenerative certified, instead of regenerative certified farms, we need regenerative certified supply chains. We fundamentally need to regenerate the capacity for stewardship. We need more people who love and care for the land and the landscape. So to have more people in the landscape, you need to be able to support them. You need to be able to pay them well. That means there needs to be a regeneration of rural economies. And so when I think about regeneration, it's really these macro pieces. I see regenerative agriculture has the potential to regenerate rural landscapes, rural communities, rural economics, regenerating ecosystems, regenerating public health, and as a part of that, regenerating soil. Now, it's easy to make the argument that regenerating soil health is the fundamental that underlies all of those pieces, and that's true, and that's why it's so seductive, but it misses the perspective of regeneration of the larger ecosystem.
All right, in the interest of time, I'll cut the clip there, but with a strong encouragement for you to follow the link in the show notes to continue listening to that conversation as John and the podcast host get into much greater detail about specific ways that this idea of a cultivation of a regenerative relationship, not only with the soil and not only on the farm, but between the farmers and distributors and producers and retailers and ultimate end consumers, how that is not some airy, fairy, pie in the sky idea, but something that is already being done and already being shown to be of value to everyone in that food supply chain. In places like the Netherlands, again, they get into a lot of specifics that are real practical nuts and bolts information for those like myself who are geared towards that rather than simply rhetoric and hype. This is John Kempf, who is actually already doing this and working with many farmers, mostly in the United States. But as he points out, it's happening all around the world right now. It's some exciting stuff. And I think one of the important takeaways from what we just listened to is the idea that fundamentally, this is not about a specific farming practice or a specific thing to do with the soil. This is about a fundamental reconceptualization of the relationship that people have to the earth itself, where we are coming from the mindset that has been inculcated in us through the Industrial Revolution and the ultimate growing of that technocratic mindset, that the earth is this fixed pie, we must fight against it in order to extract as much as we can from it. And, oh, I guess that kind of leaves it a bit barren, so we'll have to, we'll monocrop, but we'll leave it fallow once every few years, or we'll rotate a crop here and there, and that's the way we will regenerate things. As opposed to a completely different mindset that is, no, when everything is working together, you do not need this entire bajillion-dollar industry of industrial farming practices with all of the intense chemical inputs into that and the machinery that relies, of course, on the big oil, Standard Oil, Seven Sisters monopoly, oligopoly, in order to function, etc., etc. All of that is a complete mindset change that affects every level of the food supply chain from the farm all the way to the fork and everything in between. And it is about fostering cooperation at every level rather than competition. And it is definitely a different mindset to get into. But here is where I traditionally, when I have talked about these types of practices in the past, I sometimes receive a kickback by skeptical people in the audience who say, no, well, farmers aren't stupid, James. If GMOs and Roundup and all of this, if they weren't ultimately profitable, then the farmers wouldn't be doing it. If there was a way for them to make more money by not using these chemical inputs, of course they'd do that, but they can't, so they don't. Well, no, that is not true. That is demonstrably not true, and there are many ways that we can interrogate that assumption. In fact, that goes to the heart of one of the ways that you can put your finger on the numbers that show how fundamentally sick this system is. Not only in the health effects, the detrimental health effects that are produced in the consumers of this synthetic, chemically input, genetically modified monstrosities that are going on a plate. Obviously, that is an incredible change that has been wrought in society that is demonstrable and visible to anyone who goes out in the streets and notices the overwhelming epidemic of obesity that is not only happening in North America, but now literally all around the world, as this type of farming practice is exported all around the world in the industrial food supply system works on its processed chemical gunk to feed people with crap that is keeping them sick, that, oh, by the way, will also be cured by the pharmaceuticals and other things that are produced by the same chemical companies that produce the crap that's making you sick. Like, oh, say Bayer, for example, which is now, of course, as we know, Bayer Santo. Monsanto is Bayer, which will produce both ends of the Roundup that will produce the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and the things that will cure that for you, etc. So we know about that aspect of it, but also on the other side of this process, the farmers themselves. Another way you can put your finger on the absolute anti-life, completely demonstrably sick system that has resulted is the farmer suicides. And when I say that, you might be conditioned to think, oh yeah, those Indian farmers, you know, hooked on Monsanto crops and couldn't afford their debts. No, oh yes, of course, there was that spade of farmer suicides that received a lot of attention, but it happens all around the world, including, for my American listeners, of course, in America. And we can garner this just even from recent press coverage of this phenomenon, just from this year. For example, how rural communities are tackling a suicide and depression crisis among farmers, which notes that farmers commit suicide 3.5 times more likely to commit suicide than average, the national average. Or, again, just recently, just from this past week, farmers have a high suicide rate. Therapists struggle to connect with them, which I think speaks to a number of problems, one of which is the fact that, yes, this system, as it is developed, the industrial farming system, is incredibly profitable for the corporations that control the chemical inputs and the machinery, etc., not so profitable for specifically small farmers who struggle with hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions of dollars of debt in order to simply run their operation. They have to lease the equipment and buy the chemical inputs, etc. They almost invariably have to go deeply into debt for this, and that does result in farmers committing suicide at a much greater rate than the average part of the population. So, what is the answer to a fundamentally sick system that is killing people on every end for the profit of a very few corporations? Could we possibly imagine that there might be a way to actually create value that truly is valuable for people on both sides of this equation, producers and consumers, that cuts out that corporate oligarchical middleman and their interventions, their synthetic interventions of natural processes that actually impede the natural abundance of the earth? Could it be possible? Well, yes, again, demonstrably so. And for an example of that, we will turn to a clip from a recent documentary called Common Ground, which I will put the documentary homepage up for people who are interested in taking a look at that. I have my own provisos and qualifications about recommending this documentary. I think there is some very valuable information in here. I think there is also a slight Hollywood gloss on it that I think this is a perfect introduction to the subject for people in normie world, probably for hardcore Corbetteers who understand the functioning of the system. This is probably not the best way to really deep dive into the subject, but at least it gives you some details and specifics that are worthwhile. For example, specific instances of how farms can be switched over to regenerative, sustainable agricultural practices at a profit. That, in fact, farmers can actually profit from doing this.
When I was very young, I wanted to farm. I admired my father. I wanted to do what he was doing. And his way of farming was we would till the ground till it was black. And if it wasn't black, you tilled it again. We could till with the best of them. And you came out of the winter and do it again. That night, we got a 1-inch rain event. And I'm thinking, I sure hope we can get in the field this afternoon and plant corn. As I'm driving down the road to the field, I see something in the ditch. And the closer I get, it's like, the field is moving. The erosion moved the soil to the ditch and then leaving the farm that way. It's very hard to build soil health when you are mass destruction to the soil profile.
So if we think about tillage, that physically severs these mycorrhizal networks in agriculture. It chops them up. Resources cannot move. So then there's no more carbon moving from the plant down into the soil. And there's no movement of the nutrients moving up through the soil and to the plants. You've just severed that. That's done.
That was the epiphany moment for me at 42 years old. It's time to make a change. That next spring, we took all the tillage out. So we're already ahead of the game on cost. In the fall, that field was our best yielding corn field on the whole farm. And it wound up being number one on return on investment because we eliminated tillage. I am hooked. 4 years in, we were full blown.
Rick Clark is one of the first farmers to crack the code of large-scale, no-till, regenerative, organic agriculture. To do this, Rick uses two special machines.
The best tool we bought was a roller crimper. This is our roller crimper. This is what I call my baby.
A roller crimper is like a steamroller. It smashes the cover crop down. The dead cover crop protects against weeds and becomes food for the microbes.
That's our mat to suppress weeds so we no longer need to spray Roundup.
The other machine, called an air seeder, AKA no-till drill, plants the seeds without tilling the soil. Industrial agriculture uses expensive chemicals to fertilize crops and kill weeds. But regenerative agriculture uses free microbes and cover crops to bring nutrients into the soil.
Right now, where we're standing in Midwest America, there's thousands of pounds of phosphorus and potassium right below our feet. We just need to get the cover crops out there, unlock them, bring them to the surface, and regenerate them. We've got biomass covering the soil.
Biomass is the layer of cover crops protecting the soil.
We've got the microbial biome working in high gear.
The microbial biome is the life in the soil.
We've got aggregate stability that's 8 inches deep.
Aggregates are how the microbes build soil.
We've got 1.5 million earthworms per acre.
Earthworms turn plant matter into soil. The more earthworms, the healthier your soil.
We've got water infiltration rates of 20 inches an hour.
And infiltration is how much water the soil can hold instead of running off. The deeper the soil organic matter, and thus the more carbon that soil has, the more water the soil will hold.
We've eliminated seed treatments. We've eliminated insecticides. We've eliminated pesticides, herbicides. We are saving upwards of $400 an acre on input costs. It works out to be about $2 million a year in savings. That is serious cash. I have not taken a government subsidy since 2019. I no longer take any crop insurance.
All right, so as I say, that documentary has some important pieces of information, also some carbon propaganda and Hollywood slick production, which, again, may or may not be to your taste, but I think maybe a good entree to this conversation for the people in your life who are stuck in normie world. At any rate, take it for what it's worth. There is a specific example of a specific farmer who had a specific case of success with regards to implementing these regenerative agricultural processes, not only in terms of abundance, but in terms of profit. Because, let's be real, a practical solution to the intense, incredible, interlocking web of the corporate oligopoly that has inserted itself as the would-be rulers of the world in this incredibly incestuous board of directors web of entities that are steering the future of the food supply and the industrial farming system and the chemical inputs and all of this, in order to truly dislodge that parasite from feeding off of humanity, we have to have a system that will be profitable, if not merely in capitalistic terms, but certainly in those terms as well. There has to be an actual business model that people can turn to, because unless and until there is a way of actually showing people, no, this is genuinely good for your bottom line to do this, many, many people will not do it. That is just the way it is. So I think there is a very practical side to this as well, and for people who are practically oriented, it is good to know about these cases and probably to turn to something like the Regenerative Agriculture podcast, where John Kempf talks about his consulting experience, and he has consulted with many, many, many farmers over, I think, going on 20 years now, about how they can transform their practices, and he talks about a lot of the very, very, very various different success stories he has had with that process and implementing these types of solutions. So there is that practical side of it, and there is an entire industry to think about when it comes to the type of changeover that's going to be required in order to avoid that future of food that the technocratic tyrants are bringing about, because they know how to extract money and profit from this system. And unfortunately, a lot of people, one way or another, will go along to get along in a system that has been constructed for them. And they need to see the example of people who are making a living, being profitable, actually thriving on another system before they will turn to it. And that, thankfully, is already happening. So there are many, many things to talk about with regards to this. One of which is, as John Kempf noted at the beginning, regenerative agriculture is becoming more and more synonymous with regenerative practices with regards to soil health. It is becoming almost synonymous, which he has his misgivings about, because it is certainly not simply about the soil. But soil regeneration is an important aspect to regenerative agriculture. And in that regard, I can point you to some resources that I've come across that at least start the conversation with regards to that. For example, a post up from Noble Research Institute about the fundamental principles of regenerative agriculture and soil health, which goes through the six key soil health principles that John Kempf was mentioning in his clip earlier in this podcast. Know your context, cover the soil, minimize soil disturbance, increase diversity, maintain continuous living plants/roots, and integrate livestock. There's plenty more information on each of those. And then there are indicators of soil health. How do you actually measure and track progress with regards to this? There's cover, color, biological activity, soil structure, rooting resistance, smell, erosion. And then there are ecosystem processes to think about with regards to energy flow, water cycle, nutrient cycle, community dynamics. before getting into the rules of adaptive stewardship, compounding diversity and disruption. So there's a lot to this, and it is a science. There is a lot of science that goes into this. And again, these are people who are literally making their living for the soil, so they're not just making things up off the top of their head. This is something that comes from decades of careful experimentation and practices and finding out what works and doesn't work literally in the soil itself. Another potential resource along this line that I can't personally attest to, I haven't attended the Soil Food Web School, but I will note that Dr. Elaine Ingham has set up a Soil Food Web School, which offers courses for farmers and growers and everyone else on such things as a certified lab tech growing, certified lab tech program, a grower training program, introduction to ecosystem restoration, introduction to permaculture, etc., and has boasted about success on six different continents. Again, I'm not personally attesting to this, but I know that Dr. Elaine Ingham comes highly recommended by a number of people. So I will throw up the soilfoodweb.com website as a potential resource in your discovery, as well as one that's brand new to me that I just saw recently in the comment section of CorbettReport.com from Corbett Report user Home Remedy Supply, who I'm sure will be people familiar to people who spend their time in the Corbett Report comment section. He had a link up recently to a Texan who talks about dirt and soil health, the dirt doctor, Howard Garrett at dirtdoctor.com, who again has a lot of very specific, specific practical suggestions of things that people can and should be doing and how to videos, etc., etc. So there's a lot of practical information that one can garner there. But for the purposes of today's Solutions Watch, I'm going to turn to a different source, but one that hopefully will be familiar, again, to Corbett Report members and people in the Corbett Report community generally. Specifically, I'm talking about Gavin Mouncey, who, in addition to being a Corbett Report member who is frequently in the comment section of Corbett Report under the username G, hopefully you have seen and read his posts on that, but hopefully you've also followed that back to the source of that information. For example, he writes at Substack at gavinmouncey.substack.com, and he's a prolific writer there, posting many, many things on a frequent basis. So I hope you're following his work there. Also, you may or may not know, he has a book, which I have a copy of here. He was kind enough to send into the P.O. box for Pilato, who sent it on to me. It's called Recipes for Reciprocity, and it is at recipesforreciprocity.com, where you can find out about this The Regenerative Way from Seed to Table, which talks about the regenerative practices, permaculture, stacking functions, very specific and practical information, and then, as you would expect, a lot of recipes of very specific things that can be grown and made in the kitchen from the things that you were growing in the garden. So, again, very specific and practical tips for people who are serious about actually weaning themselves off of this industrial food supply processed chemical gunk system that we are stuck on. And as I said at the beginning, as I will continue to stress, as I always stress, it is not a binary off-on 100% 0% switch. It's not that if you are not suddenly completely free of the supermarket and all processed food whatsoever tomorrow, then it's a failure and who cares. It's a process of weaning and of replacement and finding what works and gradually finding your ways towards regenerative and sustainable practices that can help foster that community which will see us through to the other side of this problem of the future of food. Having said all of that, I just recorded a very interesting conversation with Gavin Mouncey about his work, why and how he does it, what he is specifically growing, and what processes and practices he uses that help him to shape his garden into something that's productive and regenerative. So, enjoy the conversation. How on earth did you get started with all this? Where did Recipes for Reciprocity come from? Why are you so interested in this subject?
Well, my parents, like I mentioned, they got a farm in the South Okanagan, So I started off through the conventional agriculture lens because they were growing apples and wine grapes and some ground crops, but they were doing it the old industrial methods where they're using herbicides and pesticides. But what I noticed is when they had a little block of grapes that died off in the winter and I used them to grow some tomatoes, I used organic methods to grow the tomatoes. And the tomatoes that I got from that little garden were just way above and beyond anything I've gotten from the store. So it was the flavor of the homegrown tomatoes that got me into gardening back when I was like 19. And I've been doing it ever since. And then the book was kind of over a decade of cooking and having fun in the kitchen and recording my recipes. And then I took a permaculture course and I thought, what a great way to combine my passion in the kitchen with something that can help other people, to show them how to grow the food as well as prepare it in the kitchen.
You know, that makes sense because it's holistic in every way, because we are taught to compartmentalize all of this, that there are people who produce and grow the food, and then there are people who distribute the food, and then there are people who sell the food, and then there are people who prepare the food, and they're all separate and disconnected, and you chop it all up into bits. Whereas, imagine if you could grow and prepare the food yourself. What a difference that would make. So I think that starts to touch on what I really want to get into today, which is the concept of regenerative agriculture, which, as you sort of allude to there, is to be contrasted with the traditional industrial farming methods that have become the standard. All of these heavy chemical inputs and machinery that is used in most standard farming practices today. Everyone has a different definition of regenerative agriculture. So I wanted to go from your book, when you write about Regeneration 101, you write, natural living systems are regenerative. They renew themselves. The materials and energy that drive living systems are cycled through that system again and again. And you say creating and supporting regenerative systems means moving beyond sustainability and actually giving back to the ecosystem around us as we take care of our own needs. I wonder if you could expand on that. How do you think of and how do you frame this concept of regenerative agriculture?
Well, it's it's like organic is avoiding the synthetics, avoiding the poisons, the pesticides, and it takes a step beyond that when you go to regenerative, because you're not just trying to sustain the land being able to produce what you want without poisoning yourself. You're actively increasing the fertility of the land and hopefully the biodiversity within and around the farm. So you're focusing on first and foremost the soil life. You're giving back to the soil life through composting, through mulching. And by doing that, it's a benefit to you as well as your community around you of non-human beings, of all the pollinators and the winged ones and everything. So it's basically to tap into the already existing abundance that's in a forest ecosystem, like you touched on in How to Eat a Pine Tree with Michael Hoffman and Jim Gale, where they talked about how if you look at a forest, it just grows by itself. It fertilizes itself. It's watered itself by the rain. And so regenerative agriculture looks to that mentality of the forest ecosystem and the self-regenerating nature of ecosystems, and then applies it in how we grow our food. And it can be on a large scale. It can be like on a rancher scale where you have cows moving around, emulating the movement of like buffalo. They're eating up the grass. They're depositing the dung. They're pulling on the roots and they're stimulating deeper root growth in the rhizosphere. There's more biological activity and that's retaining more water. So you can do it on a large scale, or you can do it, as I focused on in my book, in a really decentralized and localized scale. Whether it's just a balcony or your backyard, you can start to cycle your kitchen waste and your leaves and different things that are just thrown out by most people and build really fertile soil. And then you get some amazing food in the process.
You know, what you talk about there raises, I think, one of the important aspects of all of this, which is that fundamentally, this is almost a mindset type of thing. Because I imagine a lot of the reason that people have their reservations about this is that we are, generally speaking, in a mindset of it is us versus nature. And we are trying to tame nature, essentially, to do our bidding. And how do you do that? Well, you do this monocropping and you have to use all these pesticides and chemical inputs and you have to basically fight against the earth in order to get it to produce abundance. Whereas, well, obviously the earth is abundant and it does function even without any human input. How can we use that is a very different mindset to get into. Can you speak to the mindset flip that has to take place there and how even yourself perhaps had to overcome some of your initial programming with regards to this?
Yeah, you know, you're right. It is a mindset, because people have been conditioned into the mentality that we're taming, we're making a useless wasteland or wilderness place into something useful by putting straight rows in, by getting rid of the biodiversity and then imposing one crop onto a place. But in doing so, you don't recognize the already abundance that's inherent there. So one of the steps that helped for me was to start recognizing plants that are already growing wherever I'm living, that are providing medicine and food, especially that did, you know, eons past for the indigenous people, because you can begin to see that they already had a farming system that was providing for them, as they just recognized the abundance and then propagated it and continued it. So going out and just taking the time to learn like 10 plants that are growing in my immediate vicinity and look at the forest ecosystem helped me to get past the thinking that you have to have straight rows and a big line of crops to produce something abundant, because you can recognize it in the forest.
So you mentioned how important and fundamental the soil itself is to this process. And again, I think the mindset that most people have is that when you plant some crop, you are taking the nutrients out of the soil. And the way to essentially regenerate the soil would be to leave it fallow for a year or to rotate crops. But obviously, there are crops that can actually fix nutrients back into the soil and can regenerate the soil itself. Talk about cover crops and specifics of the types of things that people can do to actually start building a healthy soil.
For sure, yeah. There's when you look in, you know, the forest, you've got communities of plants. Some of them are creating huge amounts of biomass that's going down onto the soil. It's decomposing, it's retaining moisture, it's adding SOM or soil organic matter, and it's building the ability of the soil to hold nutrients and water. Some of the plants that exist in the forest are nitrogen fixing. So when you emulate that in the garden, you're looking at leguminous plants. You're looking at things like lupins, of course, beans and other legumes. And so you plant those intermittent throughout in a forest garden, throughout perennial crops. And they're literally, like you say, they're pulling in the abundance that's in the atmosphere of the nitrogen, which is that thing that all the governments are freaking out about and trying to restrict people in the synthetic sense, which is, it's all around us. And they're fixing it onto the root nodules, and then the neighboring plants are getting access to that fertilizer. So that's one of the things that's an ancient companion planting system called Three Sisters. So the First Nation people on Turtle Island, now known as North America, they would grow corn, bean, and squash together. And they would grow the corn as the tall member that would support the beans. And then they would grow the squash at the base to choke out the weeds. And the beans in that case were the nitrogen fixing member of that companion planting system. So they were literally fertilizing their companions, and they were all working together towards a synergistic abundance that they alone couldn't accomplish. So in the context of the garden, I like to, when I do a raised bed, I'll throw sow out some clover seeds. I'll also plant things, like I said, like lupins adjacent to my blueberry plants, let's say, or my apple trees. And so they're bringing in the pollinators simultaneously, and they're feeding into the plant roots. And so instead of having to add that synthetic NPK like Miracle-Gro, I'm getting it right from the atmosphere. I'm pulling it in from all around me.
You know, it's almost like the earth is naturally abundant, and you just have to find the ways that it works together naturally. So let's talk about your situation in particular, because, of course, this is the type of thing that is going to look different in every different climate and every different environment. So let's talk specifically. I understand you're in Southern Ontario. Tell us about the garden that you have going right now.
So what we had originally was, when I first got here, I was just starting to learn about permaculture. So I had straight rows, and I was just starting to learn about companion planting. But as I understood more about soil ecology, and I learned about things like hugelkultur, which is emulating forest decomposition to build soil matter by putting rotting wood down under the ground, what I did was, as I excavated the sod, because, you know, grass is totally useless, symbol status from eons past that people spend huge amounts of money growing, and I thought, what a ridiculous waste of space. And I carved that out. I dug down about a 1-inch trench down underneath the sod. I put in some decomposing wood from the forest around me down there. Then I flipped the sod upside down so it could become food for the soil organisms on top of the wood. And then I put things like compost and some leaves and grass clippings. And then as I built my raised beds up about a foot and a half, 2 feet with some cinder blocks and natural wood, I put the topsoil on top of that. So I created like a long-term soil nutrient cycling system. So the earthworms are going to be down there. They're going to be moving all the nutrients from the rotting wood up to the roots of my plants in the topsoil. And when the perennial crops reach the roots down, they're going to tap into like a sponge of water. So in the drought, the apple trees and the blueberries and all those guys in there, they're going to be able to get water when I can't or don't want to have to water. Because the idea is to let nature do the work for you when you're doing permaculture, when you're doing regenerative agriculture. So yeah, we created these raised beds, and they've got basically the water reservoir through the decomposing wood. And then I top dress them with compost that we make from like yard clippings, kitchen clippings and stuff like that. And that's all it takes. And they basically operate on the rain cycle. So I have crops that are drought tolerant by the breeding that the indigenous people have put into them, like Hopi amaranth, for instance, or Hopi red blue corn. And so I basically don't water them at all. I just have the rain cycle. That might be different in an arid climate. You know, you might have to work something out a little different because here we get a solid amount of rain from the Great Lakes. But we have our raised beds in the center of the yard. And then on the corners of the yard, we have taller members of a forest ecosystem. So we've got pawpaw trees, which are an unusual North American native fruit tree not many people know about. They've got these big mango-sized fruit that taste kind of like bananas. And so those are on the corner of the yard. And then I've got serviceberry trees, which are produced berries kind of like blueberries on another corner of the yard. And I'm climbing vines, medicinal vines and grapevines up those trees. So we're stacking functions vertically to make use of the vertical space. And then in the front yard, I did an article on Substack to help others with this too. If you've got neighbors that are a little bit anal about having only ornamental plants, or you've even got municipal laws where they enforce only lawn in your front, you can do kind of sneaky undercover ways of growing medicine and food. So I had covert food gardening in the era of lawn Nazis, I think was the name of my Substack article. And so I talked about how we plant elderberries out in the front yard along the driveway. And they're really beautiful, so people think they're just there to look at, but they're, of course, producing the elderberries I'm making medicine from. And then alongside them, we've got echinacea, which, again, you can make powerful medicine from. More service berries or Saskatoon berries, which you probably know from your homeland in Alberta. Those ones are amazing producers and also nice flowers in the spring. And then, we have a range of different medicinal and edible plants in the front, amaranth included, which looks really beautiful with the leaves.
Guerrilla gardening of the best kind. Excellent. Well, okay, but there will be people out there saying, well, okay, great, it sounds wonderful and virtuous, but there will be pests. There will be weeds, or at least things that you don't want growing in your garden. What kind of weed and pest control can you use if you're not going to use chemical inputs?
Well, in regenerative ag, the idea is to plant the plants that you want to be there to the degree that they outcompete the unwanted plants. So if you're going to plant a rich cover crop diversity of clover and maybe some daikon, because daikon is well known in Japan, and it's also really well known in regenerative agriculture and gardening because it's a phosphorus and calcium hyperaccumulator. So you could put it in the soil. I think you touched on this in another episode with the community gardening, and it'll pull up all these minerals from deep in the soil. And then if you let it decompose in place, it creates these pockets for roots to go down. And so if they're all there growing, they're going to outcompete the unwanted plants like weeds. And then another tactic, if you wanted something more clean looking and not a whole diversity of plants in close proximity, is you could just mimic heavy decomposing amounts of material in the forest through mulching. So you could put your elderberries and your other things, your undercover medicine plants out front or in the back, and then put down a heavy layer of like 4 inches of cedar bark mulch or hardwood mulch. And that mimics the decomposing process in the forest. It provides a great breeding ground for mycelium of beneficial fungi like mycorrhiza. And so it's helping the roots of the plants. It's suppressing the ones you don't want to be there. And then for pests, basically I just promote a robust ecosystem. Like if you have wolves in an ecosystem in a forest, they're going to maintain the numbers of deer, the herbivores. In my micro ecosystem, the alpha predators are probably praying mantis. So I plant things that are going to attract those guys and let them have habitat to overwinter, like echinacea. They love to set their egg sacs on, anise hyssop and other plants. And I create homes for other predators like ladybugs to invite them in. So they're all cruising around there and they're getting rid of the aphids. They're getting rid of the mites. And so I might see a little bit of the mites or the caterpillars start on some things, but usually the predators will come in and they'll mitigate their numbers to the point where I'm not really impacted by it.
I'm thinking about how to frame my next question, because I imagine the exhaustive list would probably be impossible for you to go through in just a short conversation like this one. But what kinds of crops are you growing? What are you actually growing in your garden?
Oh, yeah, that would be a pretty big list. I think we've got now 27 different kinds of berries growing in the garden, just alone for berries. But the service berries are one of my favorite. We're just harvesting those right now. So they're big purple berries, and the birds love them. But I'll leave the top half of the tree for the birds, and I'll have the bottom half because they're actually going to be predators and get rid of the caterpillars off of my kale. So I'm kind of paying them a little tariff to help me out in the future. And then I've got the amaranth, which is one of my favorite. Amaranth is it's a crop down from South America, and it has the leaves, which are very nutrient dense, and then as well as the seeds. And you can use the seeds like you would quinoa. You can use them. I actually ferment them alongside soybeans and other legumes and make miso paste. So I like to make Japanese cuisine with those too. And then we've got a variety of heirloom tomatoes. We've got a bunch of heirloom chilies. I love my spicy food. So we've got all kinds of purple chilies and different hot chilies that will ferment and make hot sauces. And we've got the pawpaws. We've got corn, the purple corn. And I'm really focusing right now on native tree species that can provide food and medicine. So I'm propagating hickory trees, which there probably won't be room for one in my yard, but I'm working on projects abroad to help them go into the community because they provide a nut similar to pecans. Yeah, we have figs on the side of the house. I've got in the berry section, we've got gooseberries, black currants, red currants, yellow gooseberries, blueberries, elderberries, goji berries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, golden Peruvian berries, and then there's a whole bunch of other ones I'm forgetting. But we like to continually harvest from them, and we'll put them into jams, freeze them, make stuff in the winter, and then we've got cutting down on the grocery bills in the winter, which are exponentially increasing nowadays with all the government scams.
And what size of a plot are we talking about here?
We've got a typical urban suburban yard. So our backyard has got to be just 100 feet or so across. And same with the front, just a little more elongated to the street. So we're putting out enough food where if we really went to it and we preserved every bit we could, we'd be fine to survive on what we're growing. We buy food for convenience, but in the capability of being able to supply for an emergency, we could be fine on our own.
Well, of course, I will direct people to Recipes for Reciprocity for some of the many, 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 many ideas you have for preparing these types of foods. But currently, what kinds of things are you enjoying preparing in the kitchen?
Well, I just shared a thing on Substack. I harvested our first pepper harvest early because what we did was we overwintered some peppers. So most people don't realize that pepper plants in their native habitat in Central America, they can live multiple years. They're not an annual like we grow them in Canada and the States. So we bring them inside, we chop them down in half and let them just grow at a smaller state until early spring when there's no frost. And by doing that, I got a pepper harvest just a few weeks ago. So we roasted up some cayenne peppers on the barbecue and some onions and some other stuff and then fermented them in the jar. So you get the probiotic action in there, feed your gut health. And that just really brings out the flavor too. And so I made a fermented roasted cayenne pepper sauce, which was great.
You know, it sounds wonderful. It sounds like a lot of work. And so I can understand there are people out there who think, oh, this is too much work. I can't get into this. But what would you say to people out there that are interested in this concept and how they can or should dip their toes into this water?
Well, just start small. Start with, if you only have a patio, start with a few pots. You can grow a lot of nutrient-dense food with just a few pots of something like kale, or you can even grow ginger from the grocery store. You can take the little rhizomes, put them right in the soil, and you'll have a nice, pretty houseplant. And then after admiring it for about 10 months, you turn over the pot, and you've got a bunch of organic homegrown ginger root. But in general, I would just say that like you touched on in the remote Amazon tribe getting internet article, you know, there's so much detrimental stuff going on the screens that can be like a neurological weapon. But just getting back and paying attention to the plants, even if it's just a couple of potted plants, instead of having to do eye bouncing, you know, maybe we're doing eye nourishing, and we start to recognize the inherent abundance that you talk about. And just like the amazing genius that's just in a single leaf, like you look at a leaf, it's a system that takes in cosmic light and transfers it into sugar molecules and a variety of other molecules and then feeds countless beings. And then if you combine that with like nitrogen fixation, you're building soil, you're building entire ecosystems, you know, with starlight. So that kind of thing I find really inspiring. But just to get started, yeah, I would say start a few potted plants of something that you think you're going to eat regularly, maybe some herbs if you haven't done it before. Basil is a great one to start with. I like growing cherry tomatoes and basil in pots because they're really prolific. And then from there, you can start to scale it up. If you've got just a balcony, you can do something like on a vertical grow system where you're climbing some vines up there, maybe some gojis or some grapevines. And yeah, just take it one step at a time. And everyone has failures. I had my crop failures where I didn't pay attention, didn't water a thing, and I had to learn the hard way. But when you do get those good harvests, it really nourishes you in a way that nothing else can.
Mental note, eye nourishing is a good topic for a future Solutions Watch, so thank you for that. But yes, okay, excellent. Lots of good resources there. But speaking of resources, I am going to throw in links to a couple of articles that you have up on Substack, Regenerative Garden, Gardening Seed, Seedling Tree Sources 2024, as well as Regenerative Resources, a recommended reading list from my library, where there's plenty to keep people occupied if they're interested in this. But perhaps a good way of winnowing down to some essentials off the top of your head, what would you recommend as some really important things that people should be reading on this subject?
Well, that's a good question. Well, one of the books I've been reading recently, because I'm focusing more on the tree ecosystem side of regenerative ag, like regenerative agroforestry, is a book by a guy called Akia Silver. He's in New York, called 10 Trees of Power. Arboreal Allies, I believe. I can send you the link for that. And he just focuses on how recognizing the abundance in nature and then planting those crops, you produce so much abundance with so little work. And then for more on the nitty-gritty science side of things, if people are interested in the soil science, there's a book by a guy called Matt Powers called Regenerative Soil, which is great. It gets into all how you're feeding the organisms and the nutrient cycling and all that kind of stuff. And then I think that documentary that just came out was pretty solid too. Common Ground. It had some parts, I could say, criticisms that kind of lend legitimacy to the whole carbon centric anthropogenic climate change narrative where they mention about climate change in it. But as a whole, they're showing people that when you team up with nature, when you team up with soil biology, you can produce abundance locally. You can decentralize your access to food. You can boycott corrupt systems, and, you know, there's solutions to the problems we face.
Excellent. A good list of resources, but of course, also Recipes for Reciprocity. I hope people will be interested in that. How can people get their hands on a copy of that book?
Yeah, so I actually created a discount code specific to this Solutions Watch. So if you go to my website, recipesforreciprocity.com, and you buy the physical book, if you use the discount code EmbodyTheSolution, all lowercase, then you get 25% off a physical copy, and I'll put in some little seeds in between the pages so people can get started growing some medicine plants. And then if you go buy the digital copy, I'll send you the link to that on PayHip, you can get 50% off using the same code, EmbodyTheSolution.
Excellent. Well, that's a deal that I hope people will take up. And hey, if you can get some seeds out of the deal, great. Wonderful. Excellent. So, recipesforreciprocity.com, gavinmouncey.substack.com. Are there any other places people should be looking for you or your work?
No, those are the main ones at this point. Eventually, I'm going to probably have a photography website, but those are where I'm focusing my energy right now. And for my next book, which is going to be on regenerative agroforestry or food forest design, you'll find that information on Substack and at my website.
Excellent. And as I hope everyone knows by this point, of course, you are also G in the comment section of CorbettReport.com. So I hope that if people have specific questions, perhaps they can ask you there.
Definitely.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I hope we can get an update on all of this in the future. Thank you for doing what you do.
I'm honored to be on here. I hope people will sign up for your website and become a paid subscriber. It might be just a little bit of money, but it helps provide decentralized support to people that are providing solutions.
Appreciate it very much. That is Gavin Mouncey of recipesforreciprocity.com. I hope you got as much out of that conversation as I did. And if you did, then I suggest that you take a look at the resources that will be provided in the show notes. Not only, obviously, the link to the aforementioned book, Recipes for Reciprocity, at recipesforreciprocity.com, and not only to the aforementioned Substack, gavinmouncey.substack.com, and not only to the articles that I brought up there on various resources that are packed with ideas for books and other things that people could be consulting with regards to these, Regenerative Gardening Seed, Seedling, Tree Sources 2024, and Regenerative Resources, a recommended reading list from my library. But I should also point out that hopefully, again, Gavin is familiar to you if you are a regular listener to the Morning Monarchy podcast, because on Wednesdays, the Food World Order edition of Morning Monarchy, on the last Wednesday of the month, if memory serves correctly, Gavin Mouncey does a Mouncey Minute for MediaMonarchy.com and will provide an article or something along those lines that James plays on the Morning Monarchy stream. So if you're not a listener to Morning Monarchy, what are you doing? And I will include the link to MediaMonarchy.com/listen so you can find out how and when to tune in. But having said all of that, there, as you can imagine, I feel like I'm only beginning to scrape the surface of an incredibly detailed and very, very interesting field of exploration that is regenerative agriculture. But perhaps that's all I'm capable of doing in a short introduction like this, and directing you, as always, to the very, very, very many resources that will be in the show notes, and using that as a way of branching out and finding more information on this subject. And if you have questions along the way, as I say, I hope that, for example, Gavin hopefully will be in the comment section of this edition of Solutions Watch, so Corporate Report members can leave your comments and questions for Gavin that way. I would imagine that Home Remedy Supply will also be populating the comment section of these parts. So if you have questions for him, he always has good gardening tips and techniques, etc. So there's lots of information to go around on these subjects. Hopefully this will wet your whistle for actually getting further into this subject. And as I say, this is just one of many explorations of the solutions, plural, to the future of food problem that I have done so far in Corbett Report history, and I'm sure there will be many more examining different aspects of this, talking to other guests, etc. So I'm looking forward to your feedback. Also, any suggestions you have of people that I should be talking to or aspects of this solution that need to be covered. Having said all of that, I hope that this has been useful to you as the beginning of an exploration of the solutions. But having said that, I will note, and I'm going to make a bold prediction here, that exactly as in the case, for example, of my BlackRock podcast, which got a lot of energy, a lot of attention, a lot of feedback, a lot of people were interested in that when I talked about how BlackRock conquered the world, a lot of people were interested in that. The follow-up Solutions Watch episode on how to defeat BlackRock, crickets. Never heard anything back about that from anyone. No one cares. So there is an interesting phenomenon. People are intensely interested in learning about problems, learning about what they, them, those are doing, intensely uninterested in solutions and in what we can actually be doing about it. If you have made it this far, all the way through, all of the information presented in this lengthy, oh my God, are you going to talk about the solution for an hour, James? If you have made it this far, then you are the hardcore of the Corbett Report here out there, and you are really the vanguard of people who actually are interested in and committed to solutions. So, first of all, my hat's off to you, and secondly, let me just give you a moment to reflect on the fact that there is always only a tiny percentage of people on the planet who really do sway public opinion one way or another. Most people are just going with whatever they see around them. And if you are the type of person that is dedicating yourself to becoming part of the answer to these problems, part of the solution, then you will be the one that is setting that example that other people will follow. And that is an incredibly profound, incredibly important role to be playing. So my hat's off to you. And I hope that this has been useful in getting some gears turning and hopefully introducing you to some new sources of information. But let's continue. Let's continue the spreading and sharing and cooperation in this exploration as we move our way forward against the technocratic food tyrants and their domination of the global food supply. Nothing, I think, there can be no conceivable issue that could be more important for the long-term future of humanity. So if you agree with me, I hope you will help spread this information around. And having said that, that's going to do it for this edition of Solutions Watch. Thank you, as always, for your time and attention.